From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Well, I think I'm mostly over the flu anyway, so I've got a deep radio voice back to normal, but not quite the addition from last week. But we've got a great show ahead for you today. We've got one of the more fascinating cases of Marian apparitions in history, which is the apparition related to Our Lady of the Revelation out of Italy. We'll be joined with an absolute expert on this topic, Sister Emanuela Edwards from the Missionaries of Divine Revelation. We'll be talking about that incredible turnaround. Perhaps it's the greatest turnaround since St. Paul's conversion. We are talking, of course, about Bruno Carnacchiola, an absolutely amazing thing that happened there in Italy in 1947. And we did an episode of Explore about this. It's one of my favorite episodes, which talks about the power of conversion. And so we'll be excited to talk to Sister Emanuela later in the program. We'll also be looking at a future American saint, Father Aloysius Ellacuria, and we'll be speaking with Father Kevin Mannion, who is the actor and promoter of that cause. And Father Aloysius, his death anniversary was April 6th, so it's a good time to talk about this future American saint. And later in the show, we'll be talking about the new programs coming out on EWTN for this week anyway, on the 17th, on Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. It's a They Might Be Saints episode of Mother Mary Teresa Dudzik, and that is the latest of all the They Might Be Saints episodes. So if you missed that one, it's only aired once. This is the second time that it's going to be airing. I'll be investigating the canonization cause of Mother Mary Teresa Dudzik, a Polish immigrant who founded her own order of nuns to care for the poor, elderly, and abandoned in Chicago. And of course, I'm a Polish guy and an Irish guy, but a Polish guy from Chicago. So Mother Mary Teresa Dudzik, her story is near and dear to my heart. And this week, we cycle back to the first episode of Explore with the Miracle Hunter going to Lourdes. And so that is on Saturday, April 13th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I travel to Lourdes to explore the details behind the Blessed Mother's miraculous apparitions to St. Bernadette and those healing waters that have resulted in inexplicable medical cures. If you haven't been to Lourdes, I highly recommend it. Is the maybe the ultimate place around the world, Catholic place of pilgrimage to go to. So go to the Vatican, but also go to Lourdes, of course, if you get the opportunity. And so if you don't get the chance, tune into the show, Explore with the Miracle Hunter Lourdes, airing on Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Later in the show, we'll be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project like we always do. We always look at the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up exactly to the day's date. So for today's date, April 13th, we've got Our Lady of the Crag from Vila Velha in Brazil in the year 1569. And the might-be saint of the day is Blessed Ronaldo Rivi, who lived from 1931 to 1945 in Italy. And the question of the week, is it true that there's been a heartbeat detected on the tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe? We've been doing some Guadalupe questions these past weeks, so we'll continue on that trend today. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we look at the miracles happening all around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And we might have reported this in the future saint of the day category that we do later in the program, but this is an interesting one because we have the announcement of the canonization cause of someone from the founder of the Marian movement of priests, and that is, of course, Father Gobbi. And for those people who don't know, Father Gobbi was an Italian who claimed visions of the Virgin Mary, or perhaps locutions more specifically, and he developed the Marian movement of priests, which has become a phenomenon worldwide. Those apparitions or those locutions have never been recognized by the Catholic Church as being authentic. However, they are seeing him as a holy man because his cause of beatification canonization is moving forward. And so the official announcement from the Marian Movement of Priests says, "With great joy, we announce that on Wednesday, May 1st, at 10:30 a.m. at the Shrine of the Holy Crucifix in Como in Italy, His Eminence Cardinal Oscar Cantoni, Diocesan Bishop presides over the solemn Eucharistic celebration with the opening of the diocesan process for the cause of beatification and canonization of Father Stefano Gobbi. And so they, with great praise, happiness, and thanks, they're all renewing their consecration to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And they say, Don Stefano was an example, an apostle to learn from her and adore and live to the glory of the Most Holy Trinity. And that comes out of Como in Italy on March 28th, 2024, that being Holy Thursday. So there are still many people out there who are followers of Father Stefano Gobbi. And so it's exciting news for them to see that this alleged visionary, alleged locutionist, but also the founder of the Marian movement of priests, is now being considered for sainthood. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize, the Miracle Hunter image of the faces of Mary. And so last week we talked with church historian Dan Cheely about the Sudarium of Oviedo in Spain, that sweat cloth or face cloth that was found, according to tradition, was that what Jesus was buried with. And so we were talking about that object in Spain. And so we also asked the question, what Spanish city is said to be the holding place of the cup of Christ, the Holy Grail? And that answer is Valencia. And writing in with that answer was Josh Matalonis from Hampton, Virginia. Thank you, Josh, for writing in. You are the winner of the prize, the image of the faces of Mary. Of course, there are people who out there will say, is that really the cup of Christ? Well, there's a couple of contenders that claim to be the cup of Christ, and we might not know if any of them really are or they aren't. But in Valencia, anyway, they believe they've got the one, the Holy Grail. So they're in Valencia. So thank you, Josh, for writing in, and for everyone who wrote in with your attempt at an answer. And this week we are talking about the cause of Servant of God, Father Aloysius Ellacuria, who lived in California. And the question is, there have been several venerables in the United States, Bishop Alphonse Gallegos, Father Patrick Payton, others who lived in California. And so the question is, who is the only canonized U.S. saint to have lived a significant amount of time in the Golden State? So we're looking for a Californian saint. If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com. And maybe you'll be winning the prize, the image of the faces of Mary. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Sister Emanuela Edwards from the Missionaries of Divine Revelation about the incredible apparitions and turnaround of Bruno Carnacchiola. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter. On EWTN, here's Michael O'Neill.
People who follow this program, they know that every Saturday on EWTN at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we have an episode of the program Explore with the Miracle Hunter on EWTN television. And we're in the middle of the second season, and we've got one of my favorite episodes coming up tonight, and it deals with the Virgin of Revelation. And most Catholics do not know this story. It's the incredible story of an improbable conversion and the apparition of the Virgin Mary in green. And we see this man, Bruno Carnacchiola, a man who hated the Catholic faith and worked to evangelize against it, who ended up turning into a catechist and an evangelist for it as a result of these remarkable apparitions that he witnessed with his children. And that'll be airing tonight on EWTN at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And we're so excited today to talk to someone from the order that sprung from those apparitions, and that is Sister Emanuela Edwards from the Missionaries of Divine Revelation. Welcome back to the program today, Sister Emanuela.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a pleasure to speak to you.
It's great to have you back on the show, and we're so excited. We're so grateful for your help with this episode, and it'll be an exciting one that airs tonight. And most people don't know about this Virgin of Revelation, these apparitions, and they haven't heard the name Bruno Carnacchiola. He's really had one of the most remarkable turnarounds, a reversion back to the faith, something on the magnitude of St. Paul the Apostle. He's an amazing, amazing story. And so, for those people who don't know the name, who was the man, Bruno Carnacchiola?
Well, Bruno, I think, as you know, he grew up in a very poor family. And really, he would say in his later life that he grew up and was brought up on the street. So as such, he only had an elementary education. He had to repeat the primary school twice in order to pass to the next level. And then, you know, his life was such that he just abandoned his schooling and lived on the streets. His parents were quite rough, and his dad, I told you to say, he was an alcoholic, and his mother wasn't very, she was a very coarse person as well. So Bruno, you know, you wouldn't say he grew up in a loving home. And that was the situation with which Bruno grew up in, and he would go to work at a young age, doing whatever job he could find where he was on the street. And I suppose, really, his life starts to change. He married his childhood sweetheart, Yolanda, and then he signed up, you know, to go and work as a soldier in the Spanish Civil War. So he volunteered for it. Being an Italian, it wasn't necessarily his cause, but he volunteered to go.
And during that Spanish Civil War, I've heard that he actually murdered some priests as he was in that war. Talk a little bit about his hatred for the Catholic faith and how that manifested itself during this war.
Yeah, I mean, certainly his experience in the Spanish Civil War, what can we say? You know, he participated, he joined up in 1936, and he participated in many battles, including probably the most ferocious, which was the Battle of Ebro, which was, you know, it was a very bloody event. And later on in his life, he would have such remorse for the violence that he caused against the people, and also his repeated unfaithfulness to his wife as a soldier. So, you know, that's kind of the background of his life. You know, following on from his youth, his violent temper, you know, would follow him into the army. And then while he was there, he befriended a German soldier called Otto, who was a Protestant. And Otto started to talk to him about God and the Word of God. And then one day they saw a church and they saw a celebration, and Bruno was going to go in because it had been so long since he'd seen any religious services, and he'd been listening to Otto for so long. And then Otto revealed, you know, he was a Protestant, and, you know, the church is a synagogue of Satan, you know, and the Pope is next to the beast of the apocalypse. And so, you know, they were all very emotive ways in order to build a hatred against the Catholic Church. Bruno would go on and he would ask for some kind of explanation. He didn't just accept it, you know, straight off. But then Otto continued to insist, and he even told Bruno that the fault of the war and who was funding all the fighting was the church and Rome. And so this led to a kind of a phrase where he said the Pope is responsible for all these wars and all this suffering.
And Bruno took this to a whole nother level, didn't he? I mean, he was beyond that. He was angry with the Pope, or that he thought that the Pope and the church were the problem of the world, but he wanted to take it upon himself to do something about that.
Yeah, he wanted to take the matter in his own hands. And in a moment of pure evil, he said, if the Pope is the cause of all this evil, I will kill him. And that, even as we know, you know, the temptation in life, these thoughts can go through people's minds, or evil thoughts can go through our minds. But they only become sins when we actually do something about them. And Bruno actually went as far as when he was in Toledo, he actually bought a dagger with which he intended to kill the Holy Father. And on the dagger, he went as far as to inscribe into it, "Death to the Pope."
Yeah.
And so he said, "As soon as I get the chance to meet the Pope in Rome, I swear I will kill him."
We're talking today with Sister Manuela Edwards from the Missionaries of Divine Revelation. And now let's talk about the scene where Bruno, approaches that area of Tre Fontana with his children. They're taking a day off, a day of recreation. And what happens next when his young son loses the ball when he's playing and Bruno has to look for him?
Yes, well, I mean, this is where divine providence starts to take over Bruno's life, you know. So what happens is they've missed the train to Ostia. So his plan was to go out to the beach, and anybody who's been to Rome knows that just a few miles out of Rome, there's the beach called Ostia. And so this was a popular place after the war to take the children. And Bruno had missed the train, though, so instead he decided to take them out to Tre Fontane, because there's a eucalyptus wood, if you like. And so his idea was that he would write this speech against Our Lady while his children played ball. And so at a certain point, you know, you've got the young one, little Jim Franco, who was four, and he was reading a comic, and the other two were playing ball. So there was Isla and Carlo, and they were playing ball, and all of a sudden the ball goes missing. And so they instantly asked Bruno if he would search for it. Bruno started to look for the ball, because there's a huge road that runs alongside where the grotto is, and so he was worried about his children going near to the road. And so while he was looking, he would call out to the young one, Jim Franco, and then at a certain point he didn't respond. All of a sudden, he would start to look for him, because just a few weeks before, little Jim Franco had got lost. So he was quite focused, if you like, on making sure that the young boy was okay, because he was liable to mischief. And then he found him knelt in front of the grotto, saying, "Beautiful lady, beautiful lady, beautiful lady."
So, sister, when the children knelt down, they saw the beautiful lady, and they began to say, "Beautiful lady." Tell us what happened next.
So when Bruno heard the children saying, "Beautiful lady, beautiful lady, beautiful lady," he thought it was a game. And so he tried to move them, but they were like marble. And so at that point, he became afraid. And so he cried out to God and he said, "God, help us." And then he saw as if two hands were coming towards him that removed the scales from his eyes. And he too saw the beautiful lady, the Virgin of Revelation. And obviously, you can imagine what Our Lady had to say to a persecutor of the church.
Mm.
She said, "You persecute me enough now. We enter into the holy sheepfold, the eternal miracle of God, where Christ laid the first stone, the foundation on the eternal rock, Peter." And so with this, Our Lady, from the very first moment she started to speak to Bruno, calls him back to the church. And I think very often there's this comparison, as you made yourself, with St. Paul, who was another persecutor of the church, because we find the phrases to be very similar, because the good Lord said to Paul, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And so in the same way, Our Lady said, "You persecute me." So Our Lady, just as the Lord, identified with those people who Bruno had been persecuting as a Protestant, because he would very often shout abuse at the priests and the Catholics as they were going to Mass. And so Our Lady called him out of all of that, telling him very clearly, "Re-enter into the holy sheepfold," which is a wonderful way, of course, of referring to the church. And so the conversation with our Blessed Mother lasted about an hour. And during that time, obviously, Our Lady said many things, but Bruno always emphasised things. He always underlined a few points. And the first one is, he told Bruno, "The true church of my son is founded on three white loves, the Eucharist, the Immaculate, and the Holy Father." And so, of course, she made a call to the teaching tradition of the church. She also said that the soil of the grotto, "With this soil of sin, I will work great miracles for the conversion of unbelievers and sinners." And so here, just as the water, at Lourdes has been blessed, at Tre Fontane, Our Lady blessed the soil, and indeed, subsequently, there have been very many miracles from the soil. Another
wonderful
aspect.
And so in one of the fascinating points about the apparition at Tre Fontana relates to the dogma of the Assumption, which came to pass later. What did Bruno learn about the Assumption then?
Well, of course, with the Assumption, Our Lady actually gave a message to Bruno for Pope Pius XII, And she said during the time when she was speaking to Bruno, Our Lady said, "My body could not die and did not die. So it could not decay and did not decay because I am immaculate. It was in the ecstasy of divine love that I was taken to heaven by Jesus." And so this message was received by the church and received by Pope Pius XII. But there's a little bit of a pre-story, because a year before, in 1946, Pope Pius XII had sent an encyclical letter to the whole church, to all the bishops in the church, asking what if they believe that the bodily assumption of the Immaculate Blessed Virgin Mary can be proposed and defined as a dogma of faith, and whether it's desired by the clergy and the people. And so from Tre Fontane, Pope Pius XII received his message, because he asked for some supernatural confirmation. And so on the 12th of April 1947, a little over a year later, he received that confirmation. And as we know, he then went on the 1st of November 1950 to actually proclaim the dogma of the Assumption. And so so just as Lourdes is, if you like, related to the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, at Rome, Our Lady confirmed the dogma of the Assumption. Very, very important. Of course, Our Lady confirmed the dogma before it was proclaimed at Tre Fontane, whereas at Lourdes she appeared after the dogma had been proclaimed.
Absolutely. It's an incredible aspect of this apparition at Tre Fontane there in Italy. We've been talking today with Sister Emanuela Edwards from the Missionaries of Divine Revelation about the incredible conversion, turnaround of Bruno Cernacchiola when he saw the Virgin Mary in green with his children, and went on to not assassinate the Pope, as it turned out, and went to confess that in perhaps one of the world's most dramatic confessions, I would have to imagine, when he did approach the Holy Father with that news. Well, we're so grateful to you, Sister Emanuela Edwards, from the Missionaries of Divine Revelation, for joining us to tell this incredible story of the Virgin of Revelation. Thank you so much for being with us on our program today.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a great pleasure.
God bless. That was Sister Emanuela Edwards talking to us. She's a member of the Missionaries of Divine Revelation, talking about the Virgin of Revelation and the apparition in 1947 that was claimed by Bruno Cernacchiola. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Hey, I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love getting the questions emailed in to me, and I try my best to answer them. And I pick one winner to read on the show each week. But I also like getting the questions that I get when I give presentations. I travel around the country, maybe giving as many as 20 talks per year at different Catholic shrines or parishes or organizations. And these days I've been talking a lot about Eucharistic miracles, because we're right in the middle of the Eucharistic revival from the U.S. Bishops' Conference, and many parishes are looking for ways to bring people closer to the Eucharist. And so I try to give presentations on Eucharistic miracles when I'm given the opportunity. If you'd like to invite me to speak at your parish, you can go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and click on the contact tab and send me a message that way. And maybe I'll be speaking somewhere in your area sometime soon. And so for today's question, we have a question that came in. Is it true that there has been a heartbeat detected on the tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe? In some recent weeks, we've been asking some questions and answering questions related to the tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Those people who know me, my friends, know that my favorite Marian devotion of all is Our Lady of Guadalupe. I've been there numerous times to Mexico City to see that image emblazoned with the picture of the Mother of God. That was the cloak of St. Juan Diego. And there have been so many miracles that have been attributed to Our Lady of Guadalupe and miraculous phenomena surrounding that tilma. But we have a lot of, I don't know what you might call it, but extra miracles that have been attributed or claimed to be on that cloth. I think at some point they said that the coloring on the cloth floats above the image, and that's not true. It penetrates all the way to the back. Or there's been a claim that some light has emanated from the womb area on that tilma, and that perhaps was just a visual artifact in some camera. And then there are some who have claimed that there is an actual heartbeat or a temperature of a human, around the human level of temperature on that tilma. And unfortunately, those things aren't true as well. So we do have many fascinating phenomena, perhaps related to the eyes, perhaps related to the long-lasting nature of that cloth that should have decayed in 30 years, and it's been in existence since 1531. Perhaps there are other things that people point to as miraculous related to that tilma, surviving the nitric acid spill or the that bomb that went off in 1921 in its presence. So there have been numerous things that people point to that say this is a remarkable, miraculous image, and they don't know how it was made, of course, but there being a heartbeat present on the image, detected on the image, that's not one of them. So it's always important to stay with those things that have been verified by science, and the heartbeat claim is not one of them. So thank you for writing in with that answer. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up exactly to the day's date. You all know Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th. But believe it or not, for each and every day of the calendar year, there's a different way that it lines up with Mary. So it could be a feast day, it could be the commemoration of a miracle, the building of a basilica, or another event that ties to Mary from somewhere around the world. And so for today's date, we've got April 13th, Our Lady of the Crag from Vila Velha in Brazil in the year 1569. And the story goes that perched on a giant rock across the bay from the state capital, Vitoria, the monastery of Our Lady of the Crag, got its start in 1558 when Franciscan missionary Pedro Palacios arrived, bringing from Portugal a painting of Nossa Senhora de Alegrias, Our Lady of the Joy, the first painting in Brazil. In 1569, the statue of Our Lady of the Crag arrived from Lisbon, and the shrine is named after a famous black virgin of Pena de Francia from Salamanca. Over the years, the Brazilian sanctuary, too, became a magnet for pilgrims, and in the Hall of Miracles displays so many ex-votos left in thanksgiving. And in 1570, the Festa de Pena began, starting on Easter and culminating 8 days later, a celebration that now attracts some 600,000 participants, and that is Our Lady of the Crag on April 13th in Vila in Brazil in the year 1569. For more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can connect to the Facebook page and join any of the 10,000 followers or download the free app, 365 Days with Mary Marian Calendar, available in the Apple App Store. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we talk about those people on the path to sainthood, from miracle workers to martyrs to those ordinary people living extraordinary lives of heroic virtue. These are the people that make us wonder if someday they might be saints. And of course, this connects with my television series, which airs on EWTN on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and with my book of the same title, They Might Be Saints, which is available from EWTNRC.com. I've written a number of books. In my opinion, that book is my best one. And we always try to keep you up to date with those people on the path to sainthood. We're talking about venerables and blesseds and servants of God, those people who don't have all their miracles yet and are recognized by Rome. But on Thursday, March 14th, the Holy Father, Pope Francis, received an audience. Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, the prefect for the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, and during this audience, the Pope authorized the same dicastery to promulgate a decree regarding the heroic virtues of the servant of God, Maria Maddalena Francescobaldi Caponi, a faithful laywoman and mother of a family, founder of the congregation the Passionist Sisters of St. Paul the Cross, and she was born in 1771 in Florence and died there in 1839. And she was a faithful laywoman and mother of a family. She founded the Congregation for the Passionist Sisters of St. Paul of the Cross. She was a mother of a family and founder of the religious community and had a reputation as a, quote, virtuous woman full of charity. and she was raised in a very religious family environment. She shared her Christian faith with her husband and showed a particular devotion to the Eucharist and to the Virgin of Sorrows and Saint Joseph. And so that is now Venerable Maria Maddalena Francesco Baldi Capone. With one miracle, she'll be declared a blessed, and with a second miracle, she'll be Santa Maria Maddalena. And so that was the Might Be Saint for today. And if we look at the Might Be Saint of the day, we look at people who either have a feast day on the day's date, or we look at someone with their death anniversary. And so for today's date, we've got Blessed Ronaldo Rivi. And he was born on January 7th, 1931, in San Valentino de Castellarano in Reggio Emiliano in Italy. And he was born to a farming family and was a seminarian in the Diocese of Reggio Emilia Gastala, and with a plan to become a missionary priest. But he was abducted, abused, and tortured for 3 days, and then murdered by communist partisans for being a Christian martyr. He died. He was shot on April 13, 1945, in a wooded area near Piani di Monchio in Modena in Italy. And he was declared venerable on March 27, 2013 by Pope Francis in a decree of martyrdom, beatified on October 5th by Pope Francis. And this celebration happened in Modena in Italy by Cardinal Angelo Amato. And so that is Blessed Rolando Rivi from Italy. With one miracle, he will become Saint Rolando Rivi. And that is the Might Be Saint of the Day. For more information on They Might Be Saints, you can go to the website, theymightbesaints.com, and you can also find out about the next episode of They Might Be Saints, which airs this week on Wednesday, April 17th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Mother Mary Teresa Dudzik is the subject of the canonization cause that I look at. She's a Polish immigrant who founded her own order of nuns to care for the poor, elderly, and abandoned in Chicago. Again, that's Mother Mary Teresa Dudzik, and that program is available on April 17th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on EWTN Television. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be speaking with Father Kevin Mannion, the actor and promoter of the canonization cause for Father Aloysius Alacuria. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who tune into this show know that we like talking about saints and future saints, and more specifically, saints who lived here in the United States. And there are various causes along the path to sainthood. And in my book, They Might Be Saints, I talk about the venerables and blesseds, those people who have been recognized by Rome, and they're seeking their miracles that will advance them along the cause to becoming named a saint. And there are numerous others throughout the history of the United States, servants of God, as they're termed. And one of those servants of God is Father Aloysius Alacuria. And we're joined today by the actor and promoter of that cause, and that's Father Kevin Mannion. Welcome to the program today, Father Mannion.
Good morning, Michael. You know, the actual actor and promoter is a nonprofit that we set up. The Archbishop of Los Angeles, Jose Gomez, wanted us to make sure we had incorporated. So although the original petition that I sent to the Archbishop of Los Angeles was signed by myself, because I thought it was high time that we looked at Father Aloysius, and I actually petitioned him for to consider a sainthood cause, he sent me to his tribunal, and they have a, at that particular time, it was Tom Anslow, who was the vicar for canonical services, and what they require so that there is continuity in a cause once it begins is it should be a juridical person like an association. So we founded the Association for the Beatification and Canonization of Father Aloysius, to comply with what the church requires. The whole idea is when a bishop actually does give his approval for going ahead with a sainthood cause, he wants to make sure that the sainthood cause is well-funded and can complete the process from the beginning to the end. And of course, in the meantime, a particular person like myself or others that knew Aloysius, the friends of Father Aloysius, many of them over a period of time might pass away, and you don't have the continuity. So with a juridical person, like an association for the beatification of Father Aloysius, that's a juridical person that continues even the death of, even after the passing away of, let's say, the founders and so forth. So to technically make the statement the way it should be, it's actually the actor and promoter is the Association for Beatification and Canonization of Father Aloysius Ellacoria.
Wonderful. Well, we're grateful to have all the details correct. I think that's important in the proceeding of these canonization causes. Of course, it's a very long process when these causes get first initiated and then considered by Rome, and then the search for miracles and the declaration of venerable, then blessed, then saint. It's a very long, drawn-out process. In the case of some saints, it takes centuries. We're hoping for a much quicker process for Father Aloysius, of course.
I had visited, and I believe it was the year 2009, which must have been about 15 years ago, I visited the Claretian postulator. Father Aloysius was a member of the Claretian missionaries, and he died in 1981, and it was close to 30 years before we made the petition to the Archbishop to consider sainthood cause. But in the meantime, I had visited the Claretian General House in Rome in about, I think it was around 2009. I spoke with the Claretian postulator at the time, and he said what is essential for a sainthood cause is that those who support the sainthood cause, it can take a very, very long time. And the many reasons, many times there is a sainthood cause where the original promoter or organization passes on into history, like in the case of Venerable Mary of Agreda. She's venerable. She never went further to beatification or canonization because there's no promoter to take the cause forward. If the initial interest, let's say, dies with the first promoter, you don't have a second promoter moving forward, you're not going to get much further. So it takes, let's say, the determination of the group that actually wants to go ahead and propose the sainthood cause to actually persevere and make sure there's continuity, which is why, again, the Archbishop asked that we set up the association, which would continue, after, let's say, the death of the original actors or promoters. But that's the case. In the case of Sister of Maria of Agreda, who wrote The Mystical City of God,
right,
there was no active people stepping up to the plate after the original promoters passed away.
Amazing. Yeah, it's such an intricate process that most people don't have any understanding of how that works. So we appreciate all the details. And especially, I think we want to shine the light on Father Aloysius Ellacoria. Most Americans don't know that name, even though he lived here at some point in the United States. So let's take it back to the beginning. Who was the man, Father Aloysius Ellacoria?
All right. He was a Basque, a person from the Basque provinces of Spain. He was born in 1905, and he came from a very religious and pious environment there. In fact, the Basque provinces, I believe, have well over 100 beatified and canonized just in their geographical area, because they are such a pious people. At least certainly that was the case before the Vatican Council. And you got the case of St. Ignatius of Loyola. He was Basque. Francis Xavier, he was a Basque. Even in the case of the founder of the Opus Dei, although he's in the southern part, of the Basque country, you could be considered he's Basque, but very religious and pious people who have a very simple and yet very strong faith in the Catholic religion. And actually, their environment and the culture is very, very Catholic. So he was born 1905. One of his playmates when he was like, 10 or 11, actually probably 7, 8, or 9, lived in a town about 20 minutes away called, his name is Domingo of the Blessed Trinity. He's now a beatified saint out of the Trinitarians. He was a playmate of Aloysius. So you can just imagine them going on the mountain hills from one city to another. And here they are, these little 8 or 9 year olds, and they were friends with each other. At that time, of course, it's a small world at that time. You've got the local pastor of the parish where Father Aloysius lived in a place called Biscay. Uray has since changed his name to Igore, which is the Basque instead of the Spanish designation of the town. It's now they use the Basque name, which is Igore. Well, the parish priest was the uncle of this Domingo, who later became beatified out of the Trinitarians, and he was Aloysius's pastor, and he had baptized Aloysius the very day after Aloysius's birth on June 21st of 1905. On June 22nd, he was baptized, which happened to be that particular year the feast of Corpus Christi, and of course a very Catholic feast, one of the main feasts. Of course, what differs our particular faith and let's say non-Catholics is we have the body and blood of Jesus Christ. So the feast of Corpus Christi is the biggest, one of the very biggest in the Catholic calendar, after Christmas and Easter and the Marian feasts. But Aloysius lived in a small town where the local pastor at that particular time, there's not the concept that we have in the States of separation of church and state. Instead, you got the local pastors on the what would be considered the city council. Not that he actually, votes one way or the other, but he does give his recommendations, or he is there, blesses, opens the meeting, and so forth like that. So you've got a kind of an old-time culture that actually produces heroic virtue. It produces sainthood. It produces, I guess, a piety. It produces whatever we might consider would be what would be great in the Catholic faith, which is a family-based, very close to God relationship, I guess, lifestyle. Anyway.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Father Kevin Mannion from the canonization cause for Father Aloysius Ellacuria. And he's of particular interest, I think, to people here in the United States because, although coming from Spain, he ended up coming to the United States. He had a desire to work in the missions, perhaps, and went to Panama at some point, and then ended up in the United States in California. Tell us a little bit, when Father Aloysius came to the United States, what did he do? What was his mission here?
All right. Aloysius was sent to the United States because, of course, as a Claretian missionary, and the name of the Claretians, the official name, is the Congregation of the Missionary Sons of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. He came to be a missionary, and his expertise after he had been ordained had been as a teacher of Greek and Latin. So as they needed in the seminary formation process here in California or in the United States, a professor that would teach the seminarians Greek and Latin, Aloysius was capable in that particular area, and that was his expertise and why he was sent into the missions to be a missionary, but a formator of missionaries. So he was sent as a seminary formation professor. Of course, he's 30 years old. Actually, he's ordained when he's approximately 24 years old, and he comes to the States, and probably in his late 20s and early 30s, that's when most of his time is spent in Claretian missionary formation in the seminaries. And at that time, there was the junior seminary system that still exists in some countries, but in the United States, we don't have, that approach. But he became very good at discerning which vocations were, had true vocations and which vocations should not be in the seminary. And so they would study to be, let's say, a professed religious or later maybe go into the seminary to become a priest. Aloysius had a certain sixth sense, so to speak, about discerning religious vocations. So that may have been an interesting reputation that he developed, so much so that after 10 years of serving as a professor and as a language teacher, he's nominated or given the charge of being the rector of a seminary, and this time in Moman, Illinois. And they build a seminary. He's the rector. And for about 3 or 4 years, He actually runs a seminary. So it's he's quite practical. And as someone coming from Europe and especially the Basque area of Spain, they are very good as entrepreneurs or business people. They're very practical. They know about buying and selling. They know the prices, what's a good price, what isn't. So Aloysius, not only is he holy, he's practical. And many times we wish we saw more of the practicality, although that's always going to be the case.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I find so fascinating about the life of Father Aloysius is he lived in Los Angeles, and he promoted the scapular, and he was a superior of a provincial house in Westchester, and great fame surrounded him. And one of the things that I think was so interesting about him is how much time he spent visiting and consoling the sick and the dying and providing spiritual relief for those people. Talk a little bit about that charism that he had for caring for the sick.
All right. Well, while he was a seminary formator, I guess we would call it, when he was in the formation and it was located in Dominguez, where the Claretians have actually a seminary dedicated to St. Anthony Mary Claret, who is the founder of the mm-hmm. Claretian missionaries, some people begin to seek Father Aloysius' advice as a spiritual director. So going back to 1948, there are some who I spoke with that remembered that when Conrad Hilton, who was the founder of the Hilton Hotel chain, when he was in the Los Angeles area, I believe he lived in Beverly Hills for much of the time he was in Los Angeles, he would drive up in a black limousine to the Dominguez property or that particular St. Anthony Mary Claret Seminary. And when Aloysius, when he was not in seminary formation, he began to get a reputation as a good spiritual director. And one of his directees was Conrad Hilton, who apparently frequented and visited Father Aloysius from 1948 up through, let's say, Conrad Hilton's death in 1979. But Aloysius's main thrust was seminary formation until the later 50s. And I believe, although we have to research this, I believe that it would happen in the 50s. There may have been a change in leadership perspective within the Claretian order, which makes sense because this is just before the Vatican Council. And Aloysius, although he is the superior there at the provincial house in about 1958, 59, 60, he is no longer in seminary formation as he was previously. And but he has established a series of rosary groups, which at that time were considered the Claretian guilds, a guild like a workers' guild out of the Middle Ages or something. You have these rosary groups, and I believe that Aloysius himself considers that over his lifetime he had founded as many as 12 different rosary guilds. And at the Rosary Guild, which started originally in the homes of various people, there's the recitation of the rosary, and not just one rosary, but you might call it at that time, there were the three rosaries. And then Aloysius would give a spiritual talk, and people would ask him questions. And we have some of those, not many, but we have some of those even on tape, the reel-to-reel tapes. And so in the process of going ahead and getting those, let's say, duplicated and in many cases transcribed, it's not the quality that you might have with, let's say, some of the more Hollywood type of sainthood causes, like in the case of Patrick Peyton and so mm-hmm. forth, where he had he actually had an institution that actually helped promote his rosary, his family rosary crusade and so forth. But Aloysius did have people that saw the value, and they actually recorded him, which is kind of remarkable. But it is takes quite a bit of a process to get that out, let's say, so that we can get it into the public domain. So far, we have a collection of, let's say, artifacts and files. We have recordings. We have what I might consider is like a Noah's Ark full of, instead of animals, this is a Noah's Ark full of all of these, let's say, artifacts relating to Father Aloysius, including his correspondence from 1919 through, let's say, his death in 1981. And we've had to go through the process of putting them into an archive form, taking them out of the original folders they were in, putting them into some type of binders that have protective sheets and so forth. But, I mean, we have quite a bit of, we have a true historical archive that we've only touched the surface of it. So that's also involved in the sainthood cause, is if you have a lot of documents, that helps. If you have a saint that doesn't have any documents, it's basically hearsay, and so the mm-hmm. church can't move forward and look at it very carefully. But if you have a case like we have with Aloysius, we've got lots of documentation. That takes quite a bit of human resource to go through and organize it and have it ready for the canonical process and so forth.
Absolutely.
I don't know if that answered your question.
And for people who want to find out more about the incredible life of Father Aloysius Ellacuria, what's the best place, website or otherwise, where people can find out more about his cause and his life?
There is a website that we put up, although in the present time it will be probably ready within 24 hours, but we've had it up since about the year 1998. It's called Aloysius.com. That's www.aloysius.com. And although it is up and available for viewing at the present time, and we also have a link if anyone wants to contribute and so forth, but that is probably the best resource because it can be approached or can it be actually contacted anywhere in the world. But I would say we need to update it quite a bit. However, that's that's probably the best first place to go, Aloysius.com.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Father Kevin Mannion, from the Cause for the Canonization of Father Aloysius Ellacuria, about this incredible future saint who lived here in the United States. People can find out more at Aloysius.com. Thank you so much, Father Kevin Mannion, for joining us on today's program.
All right. Thank you.
God bless. That was Father Kevin Mannion talking to us about the incredible life of Father Aloysius Ellacuria. I encourage people to find out more about this future saint who lived right here in the United States in Los Angeles. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Sister Emanuela Edwards from the Missionaries of Divine Revelation, and Father Kevin Mannion, the actor and promoter of the cause of Father Aloysius Ellacuria. Check out my episode of Explore with the Miracle Hunter, Lourdes, which airs on April 13th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I travel to Lourdes to explore the details behind the Blessed Mother's miraculous apparitions to Saint Bernadette and the healing waters that have resulted in inexplicable medical cures. Check that one out this week on EWTN. I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.